Father, we want to praise you for such a beautiful day, for this glorious time of year, for your testimony to yourself in all creation. We thank you too for revealing yourself to us. We thank you too, Father, for the way you show yourself to us in your power at work within your people. We thank you for what we've experienced of that in our own lives, and we thank you for what we see of it in the lives of Francis and Edith Schaeffer. And we pray, Father, as we continue to think about your work in them, that you will teach us. We ask it for Jesus' sake. Amen. We were looking at the various things that Francis Schaeffer learned during his trip to Europe in 1947. And we had got, I think, to the eighth point. And that is, I just wanted to comment on the way, as you read through the letters and his time there in Europe, you'll see that he was committed to sharing the gospel with anybody he could, wherever he went. It's really quite striking, if you read through them all, just the different examples you see of people he attempted to communicate with. In the letter I gave you, for example, letter number 10, on page 4, you have an example. He writes, "As we left, I talked to my guide of Christ. And I do not know how serious he was, but he said he wants to know more, for he had found Roman Catholicism wanting. I urged him to go to talk to the Methodist pastor, and he promised he would. I hope the Lord brings forth fruit from that conversation." Edith gives several other examples in the book as well. If you look on page 257, she gives an example there. He writes there of speaking to a Roman Catholic from Austria and the other an Anglican from Britain. These are both people who are pastors, and he speaks to them about the Lord. And then she gives another example from, this is from one of his other letters, from when he's in hospital in Oslo. When on Sunday, even though the other men in the beds in the room he's in don't speak English, he sings some hymns. And he says, "Last night I had a chance for a little testimony to the two men. I sang some hymns. I'm sure they didn't understand much, maybe only the word Jesus. But both looked thoughtful and said, 'Yah.' Before liberalism came, this was very much a Christian country." And then he says, "And don't grieve about my being sick here, because I feel the Lord has placed me here." Now, in another of the letters, and I was looking them up again today, he writes how later, when a pastor came to visit him there in the hospital, he had a chance to really communicate to the men in the beds in the room where he was through interpretation. He had a real chance to communicate the gospel to them with an interpreter. Now, as you read through the letters, there are many, many examples of this, where wherever he went, he speaks to guides, to interpreters. He writes of talking to and then praying with his landlady in one of the hotels he stays in. When he's sightseeing, he meets people and talks to them. He has a long conversation with a Chinese man who's a Confucian on the train from Holland and through Belgium to Paris. He meets a Dutch couple on the plane on the platform of the station in Utrecht. He can't find anywhere to stay for the night. They take him home with them, and he stays up till almost midnight, reading the Bible with them and talking about the gospel with them. He talks to his Jewish porter in a hotel in Holland, to the Greek owner of a hotel when he's in Greece, just to all sorts of people. It's very interesting, as you read them through, the tremendous commitment he had, and this was with him his whole life, to really seek to be some kind of testimony to anyone whom the Lord brought across his path. The ninth issue I want to just say a little bit about is his experience of God's care for him in the details of his journey. He actually writes in one of the letters, and Edith quotes this on page 261, that our God is a God of details. And of course, that's what the New Testament teaches us. Jesus said that if our Father Heavenly sees if a sparrow falls, how much more does he care for us? And that even the very hairs of our head are numbered. And all the way through the letters, you see him speaking about the way God has taken care of the details, taking him to the various individuals that he felt God wanted him to meet. Over and over again, he writes about how he has a very short space of time in each city that he goes to, and yet how God is able to oversee the details amazingly and give him the possibility of talking to pastors from all these different denominations, often at very short notice, often at no notice at all. And he has many wonderful conversations with people, even through situations which seem to be purely chance. While he's standing in a hotel foyer, for example, and he asks the man behind the desk if he knows the way to the evangelical church. The man has never heard of such a thing. This was in Greece, I think. But somebody passing the desk at the time says, "Oh yes, I know where that is." And this man comes along, it wasn't in Greece, it was in Italy, and says, "Yes, I know exactly where that is, and I'll take you there right now." Just many, many examples like that of God's providential care for him during this time. And Edith writes this: "He had gone to Europe with practically no names and no contacts, and one had led to another. Much, much later, we were to pray for the people of God's choice to come to us when Le Bris began. We didn't know about that, but at this time, we had prayed that Fran might be taken to the people the Lord would have him meet." And she's just pointing out how, as you read through the accounts, his account in these letters, humanly, having so many contacts in such a short time was impossible. But God really provided for him. The other thing that was impossible, humanly speaking, was the amount of travel that he got done when travel conditions were so difficult. Over and over again, he had people who worked in Europe saying they couldn't believe how many places he'd managed to get to in the short amount of time that he had, given the travel conditions at that time. And finally, Edith gives there the example of safety when he's flying back from Europe to the United States. The plane's engine stops flying over the Atlantic. Some of you may have read that account in the tapestry, and the engine stops and the plane starts plummeting down towards the sea, and he prays for safety, offers to help a person who's sitting next to him with their children. And it says he didn't know the full answer till later. When they reached Gander Airfield, the pilots said they had no idea why the motors started again. They couldn't understand it. But as you read through the letters, you just see over and over again the way God took care of him in all the details of the situation. And he wrote at the very end, "This trip has ended. It has been the great spiritual experience of my life, second only to my conversion. It has been wonderful to realize the unity of the Church of Christ," and so on. "Daily," he says, "I have felt the Lord's hand upon my shoulder." So it was a tremendous experience to him, these 3 months, of the way God could care for him in a completely new situation where he knew absolutely nobody, and yet God was able to go before him. Now those are the 9 issues that I wanted to mention. But we can't stop speaking about this before we mention what Edith goes on to speak about in the tapestry, and that is the cost that this journey took, the toll the journey took upon him. He returned home to St. Louis very weak physically. He'd been sick, had to be taken into hospital on that one occasion, but in addition to that, he'd repeatedly had diarrhea from the very poor food that was available, the lack of good sanitation in some places. So he hadn't eaten well. He'd lost a great deal of weight by the time he returned home. He'd often gone without sleep. By the time he came back, he was physically near a state of collapse. In addition to that, he, the whole time, was emotionally very draining. Edith writes about this on page 273, which I've I've given you there just how costly it was that he was very close to having a nervous breakdown, though not quite. They were able to avoid that by her taking such special care of him when he got home. And it was spiritually a tremendously taxing time. He missed Edith. He missed both their sexual union and also their sharing together every day, everything that they were both doing, which, as we've spoken about, they did every evening before they went to bed. They would always spend a good long time catching up with each other, having a time alone together. He missed that. He missed her enormously. She writes how it was a time of tremendous temptation for him, real battle. Spiritually facing sexual temptations and so on during this 3 months away. I think the way she writes about this is tremendously valuable. She points out that the boards of missionary organizations, of churches and so on, can make very serious mistakes in what they ask people to do, in asking too much and putting people under unnecessary strain. And I think that's an issue that really needs to be thought about. I've often felt that, for example, if we give a different kind of illustration, that when missionaries come back from some other country here on furlough, that the time is anything but a sabbatical, anything but a furlough. It's often far more stressful than the time they spend on the field. Often they're presented with two choices, one of which is the frying pan and the other is the fire, to use an English expression. I don't know if that's an American expression too, but the frying pan, if you like, to use that image, is that the husband will spend the whole 6 months of the furlough rushing around the United States, speaking in dozens and dozens of churches about his work on whatever mission field they've been sent. Once in a while he may see his wife and children when he gets back to them. Meanwhile, they are often put up in some accommodation which isn't really adequate, which doesn't really give them privacy, time to be a family by themselves. It's already very difficult because the children have to go to a completely different schooling system from what they're accustomed to. Now that's the one way that this is dealt with sometime, the issue of furlough. The other way is for the guy to take his family with him, to drag him around all the churches to which he has to speak. And sometimes people will do that. But that, in a way, is even less satisfactory, because while they're together, they're constantly sleeping on people's floors in people's spare rooms. Again, there's a total lack of privacy, a lack of home life. While one can always look back at such times and say, the Lord has taken care of us, you meet many people who are tremendously kind to you and give themselves sacrificially for you in such a situation. Even so, there's a tremendous cost, and many people return from such a furlough more tired than when they came home in the first place, simply because of the pressures on their life as an individual, as a couple, as a family. I must say, and I think I ought to suggest this to MTW, but it seems to me that the least that could be done, if one was going to require that a missionary would travel around speaking to the churches which support him, which of course is a good thing, so you can see why it happens, is that one would provide, the mission board would provide, a really large traveling home, a sort of Winnebago, where the family could just go and have a family life together for that period of 6 months, and have their own home, their own privacy, their own cooking, a time to be together as a family, and it would turn it into partly a holiday as well, because of the travel that would be there, instead of the tremendous pressure and tension that people are under in that situation. But Edith clearly feels, as you read these pages, that too much was asked of him in the time that there was, considering the conditions that there were. Now we may say as well that it's partly his own obstinacy, which we talked about before, that he really tried to do everything that he was asked to do in that time. He just didn't give up. He just kept pushing on and on and on, going to all these different places, taking advantage of all these opportunities. I think the other comment that Edith makes there is tremendously important and profound as well. And that is this, that it's very important not to be romantic about the Christian life and the cost of it. That you can look at this time of those 3 months and say, here was a time which was tremendously important time in the way God led him as an individual, the various things he exposed him to, the people he took him to, the issues he thought through, and so on. And that is certainly true. And that personally it was a time of tremendous growth for him. As I quoted, he called it the most important spiritual experience in his life, apart from his own conversion. But when God uses you in a way like that, in a tremendous way, it can be extremely costly. Whenever he uses you in a wonderful way, it is costly. And we're often not prepared to come to terms with that. We think that it's possible to be of benefit in the kingdom of God without it being painful. But the New Testament doesn't speak that way. You can think of the image that Jesus used in John's Gospel, and this was an image which became increasingly precious to the Schaeffers as the years went by, that unless a grain of wheat is prepared to fall into the ground and die, it won't bear fruit. Now, of course, Jesus was talking about himself there, that our salvation was purchased at tremendous cost to him, that we are the wheat, we are the fruit that his death produced. But the same principle applies in the Christian life as well, in the ministry. Unless we're prepared to be that grain of wheat that falls into the ground to die, we won't bear fruit either. Unless we're prepared to count the cost, to take up the cross and bear it. And Paul speaks that way very strongly, particularly in 2 Corinthians, in chapter 4 and 5, where he speaks about the way that he bears in himself the death of Christ, and that it's only as he does bear in himself the death of Christ that there is life given to others. That if we really want to be of service to God and to his people, we have to be prepared to count the cost, and the cost is sometimes very painful. And I think what Edith writes there is tremendously helpful. She says this at the bottom of page 272: "Never forget this, at any point in life, in 1,000 different kinds of situations, the answer to prayer, 'Use me, Lord, I want to be greatly used of thee,' can be the hardest thing you have ever faced. It is the answer to prayer that brings exhaustion of a variety of kinds, and that brings a cost to be paid that almost smashes you and me. There is always a cost to being used mightily for the Lord, and there always was." And she goes on to quote Paul in 2 Corinthians 1 verse 8, where he says, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia." And of course, what Paul goes on to say there is, "We were so utterly unbearably crushed that we almost despaired of life itself." That's the apostle writing. That was his experience as he sought to be a servant of God, that sometimes it was very, 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 very painful. So there's no room for romanticism about Christian service, nor triumphalism of the wrong kind. You see, Paul can say that God leads us in triumph everywhere, but Paul also speaks about the cost of that. He says, "I die daily." And when you read the account of what Paul's life was like, you understand that he meant that quite literally. That I've been beaten so many times, I've been left for dead, I've been shipwrecked, I've often been hungry, without sleep, naked, in all kinds of trouble. Paul is speaking quite literally about that cost to himself, that he had to die daily. So there's a very important spiritual lesson there. Now, there's a fine line to be drawn here. We may choose a costly path as God uses us in his service, but that doesn't justify mission boards and church boards giving people impossible tasks or tasks which are too costly. You know, we are called to to really try to bear one another's burdens, and to lift burdens off one another, not to give people impossible burdens to bear. If somebody chooses a road which turns out to be very costly, or which in God's providence is very costly, that's one thing, but it ought not to be organized by the system. As we think of the cost of Christian service, is that a cost that we should bring upon ourselves in, say, ascetic ways, like making it even more difficult than it needs to be? Is that what godliness is? I don't think so. It seems to me that life itself is difficult enough. The cost of serving God can be very painful. You know, the New Testament says that through much tribulation we must enter the kingdom, and that we have to be prepared to take up our cross. And that will be different for every individual. For one person, it may be suffering some awful illness, or having a child with leukemia. For another person, it may be constant pain of one kind or another. For another person, it may be struggling with depression. For another person, it may be having a work to do which takes an enormous toll of you. So one can't lay out what it's going to be, what that cost will be for any individual. What the New Testament doesn't suggest, though, is that we purposely do things to ourselves which are painful. The New Testament sees no value in asceticism for its own sake. You know, God calls us to enjoy the gifts that he's given us, not to purposely deny ourselves of them as if there were some value in denying ourselves. So asceticism has no value, and you can think of what Paul says in Colossians 2 about that. He says there are people who say, don't touch, don't taste, don't handle, and impose all kinds of rules on themselves. And he talks literally about the humiliation of the body, which is what asceticism really is, the humiliation of the body. And he says this has an appearance of wisdom, and it also creates an appearance of spirituality, because it makes you feel very spiritual. But he says it has absolutely no value in restraining the indulgence of the sinful nature. And Paul just rules it out completely. He says that's not what the gospel is about. Now, there will be plenty of costs in serving God without trying to bring them upon yourself. In other words, you don't seek martyrdom, either in the literal sense of final martyrdom or in the daily sense of making things worse for yourself than they need to be. That has no value. And Paul says that in Romans, in 1 Corinthians 13, you know, if I give away my body to be burned, unless my motivation is love, in other words, because there's somebody in need, that's why I'm doing this, it's worth nothing at all. This whole issue of an impossible life is something that we struggled with over and over again in Labrie. I remember Schaefer, the first time he came to visit us in England, when the English branch had started in 1971, this is just a little incidental story, but Vicky and I had been just moved in a few months, and our apartment was in total chaos. The kitchen surfaces were being rebuilt, all of our crockery to serve 20 people, and all the food was in our bedroom, and we were still serving meals in the middle of all this. And he came in to sit down and chat with us and to pray with us, and he said, "What we're trying to do is not difficult, it is impossible." And I really appreciated that at the time, though it's because it was true. It just seemed completely impossible practically what we were trying to do. And it's a question we struggle with over and over through the years. You know, should we ask of one another what is impossible, or can we try to set this up in a way where, okay, it's still going to be difficult, it's still going to be enormously costly, but it just isn't impossible practically? And I think we learned some important lessons along the way there, that you really cannot and ought not to ask people to do impossible things. I don't think in any of the branches of Labrie today we would ask anybody to do the kinds of things that we asked of ourselves 20 years ago. We just did ridiculous things. You know, I think back of the way we lived some of the time, and for example, when Vicky had our second and third sons, she, in England, you go into hospital for 10 days, which is a wonderful relief for the wife in such a circumstance, to have 10 days of being cared for after a 9-month pregnancy. But I stayed at home. I was going to visit her every day. looking after first one child who was 1 year old when our second one was born, and when the third one was born, two. One was 3.5 and the other was 2.5. And then cooking meals still for 15 to 20 people every day. I was doing that all the time and still trying to teach and preach and everything else. And I look back on it and think we were absolutely mad. You know, we would never ask anybody to do that kind of thing again. You know, we've made some very serious mistakes in terms of asking people to do impossible things. And it's something we have to be very careful about. I think perhaps one of the reasons why there's so little attention to that is because so much Christian literature, Christian biographies, and so many prayer letters and newsletters are so one-sided. And I think it's something that really needs to be thought through. What I mean is one-sided in the sense that they are triumphalist, that there are only the good stories told, only the success stories. People write their prayer letters and their newsletters and they feel obligated to only tell the good things that happen, even sometimes making up things that haven't really happened, or blowing things up way beyond the reality of what has taken place, and not being prepared to write openly about the struggles that they've gone through, about the pain they've experienced, about the difficulty, about the disappointments, about the temptations and stresses that they're under. So many Christian biographies are like that, and so much material that goes out, and we need to be to really try and strive for a biblical realism. One of the most refreshing things I think about reading the Bible is that it's so honest about people's weaknesses and failures. Not that there's anything to glory in when we read the account of the Israelites' failure over and over again, or when we read the account of the apostles leaving Christ. But in fact, it's a great encouragement to read that. They're in God's Word because we see that the struggles that we endure are not unique to us. They're common to the whole people of God throughout the ages, and God has recorded them there for us. And that is a tremendous comfort, that it was with people like us who were weak, who failed, who fell flat on their faces, who made mistakes, who were sinners, with people like us that God worked, people like us whom God loved, people like us whom God was prepared to use in the building of his kingdom. And there's a tremendous need for Christian literature to have that kind of honesty and integrity and realism about it. I think, in fact, the effect of many Christian biographies and newsletters is just to discourage Christians. Really, I think for most people who read them, it's just discouraging because they think, well, I could never be like that. As you said, these are superheroes, and we just cannot be that way. And that's, I think, one of the refreshing things about reading the tapestry, because Edith is very honest about the difficulties that they went through, including in this particular section of their lives. The other thing we need to add here as we think about this issue of cost, the cost of this time, that when one person bears the cost, as he did on that journey, somebody else always has to bear it too. And in this case, it was his wife, of course, and the children, who, when he came back, was a period of several months where he needed extra sleep, where he needed special care, where he needed extra time alone with Edith, and she had to be more creative even than usual in finding ways to care for the children, in giving him quiet, in giving him privacy, in putting off people's demands upon him in terms of the needs of the church and the needs elsewhere. It's something I'm always very conscious of. If I go off somewhere and speak, and it may be a really good time, and you feel like you really helped people and that God has used you in wonderful ways in people's lives, I always come home exhausted, and that is a cost on my wife and children, as well as on me at that point. And it's really important to remember that taking on something, doing something costly, affects other people as well as yourself. That brings us to his being back in St. Louis, both of them being back in St. Louis after that summer away. back in St. Louis, they settled into the usual round of their fruitful ministry there, with him preaching, visiting, taking young people to discussions, and in addition, doing special talks and lectures with slides about his trip to Europe. It was during this period that Edith started a Bible club, which actually originally had been a literary club. The mother of one of the children who came to one of the Children for Christ classes said, "Could you come and speak about the Bible to our literary club?" And she said, but I just don't think the Bible is a piece of literature. I think that it's true. And the woman said, "Well, come and talk anyway." So she went and talked for half an hour, and they said, "Keep on talking." And in the end, she talked for an hour and a half. And the literary club became a Bible study. It's really quite an amazing story. It's on page 274 in the tapestry. Because, of course, many of the women who went to that were not Christians. Basically, what Edith did at that was her bird's eye view of the Bible, what she was later to call that talk, which is in the little book Christianity is Jewish. But as they settled back into their life in St. Louis, their future began to be unsettled. Letters came from all over Europe to all the places he'd been, saying, "We so much enjoyed having you here. Come and help us. We need your help. Please come back." Letters came to them from all over the United States saying, "Come and tell us about your time in Europe. We want to know what's going on there." So there was a huge increase in letter writing. And really, from that point on, writing letters became a more and more important part of his ministry. He already did a lot of correspondence, but it just mushroomed from that point onwards and stayed with those mushroom proportions till the end of his life. I must say, it's something that makes me feel ashamed when I think about the conscientious way in which he answered people's letters. Just masses of people's letters all the time. And the third unsettling factor, all the letters, of course, were unsettling because of their obvious longing to have him return. The third factor which was unsettling was a meeting of the independent board, which after he gave his report on his time in Europe, and of course all these people had been receiving all these letters, so they'd had a very detailed account of that time, as well as the report that he gave. The independent board decided that somebody should go to Europe. And the expression they used was to strengthen the things that remain. And they said, "We think it should be you," to Francis Schaeffer. So they had to face the question, should we go or shouldn't we? Shall we start getting into all this correspondence or shall we not? There was such a huge amount involved that the question really had to be answered yes or no. They either had to say no to responding to all these letters in any meaningful way, both from Europe and from all over the States, and no to the independent board, and yes to the ministry in St. Louis, to the ministry of the church there, or they had to say yes to the letters, to the challenge from the independent board to go to Europe. And this was quite a struggle for them. They didn't see the way ahead at all clearly. They had no clear idea of what they were going to do if they went to Europe. So it wasn't something easy. They didn't have some nice pre-organized job to go to. A church, a Bible school, a seminary, some mission work, a place to go and live, all set up. There was just the call, go to Europe. And all these letters saying, come and help us. But nothing specific which you could put your hands on and say, this is what you ought to be going to do, or this is where you would go and live. This is what your work will be. So on the one hand, there was that uncertainty about the future. What would happen if we went? What would we do? On the other hand, there was their life there in St. Louis with a ministry which clearly was being blessed by God, which was really being used to bring people to faith, to build people up in the faith, to be an encouragement to many, many people. So a fruitful ministry. In addition, many people they loved very dearly and who loved them. and a very pleasant home there. And Edith writes about the way she'd already been dreaming of how they would be able to stay in that house for many, many years, and she could picture her daughters getting married and getting married in the house there and coming down the beautiful staircase for their wedding and so on. And of course she had such an imagination, she would have imagined all of those things. So there were many things for them to think about. They decided fairly quickly over those next few months that they would go, even though they didn't know what was coming. They had to leave many of their most treasured possessions behind. The girls had just been given a beautiful antique dollhouse, for example, which they had to leave there because there wasn't going to be room for it where they were going. So in February 1948 they left St. Louis. The children were at that time 10 and 6 and 2. They were going to spend 5 or 6 months in the U.S. first. Edith was going to live in Philadelphia, and he was going to travel around the state speaking about the time in Europe that he'd had, showing his slides, giving lectures about the situation there, and of course people asking questions about what they were going to be doing. So it was a speaking trip both looking back to what he had done and looking forward to whatever they would be doing, which would be strengthening the things that remain. And of course they had no clear idea of what exactly that ministry would be. They went to Philadelphia. Edith and the girls stayed with Francis' mother. They felt this would be a good thing, that it would give her a chance to get there, to know their children in a new way before they left for Europe, so far away, and of course travel was difficult. But that turned out to be an extremely difficult time, just as he had just had his 3 months of difficulty, of costly experience in Europe. Those months in Philadelphia were a very costly time for Edith, and she writes about that there. His mother wanted to have them, insisted on having them, but behaved all the time as if it was an imposition to have them. She felt they shouldn't go to Europe. In fact, she was furious about it, is the word Edith uses, and took it out on the girls all the time that they were going. So Edith's work was cut out in keeping the girls out of her mother-in-law's hair, in doing everything she could to try to serve her, to help her take care of the home, to do everything she could to make life as pleasant as possible, and then create a little bit of time for her to study to be a secretary, because from then on she was going to be his secretary as they went, and she had to learn shorthand and she had to learn typing. But every time she went into her room and closed the door and started working on it, her mother-in-law was just really angry and clearly regarded this as a total waste of time and that she should have been doing something more worthwhile. So it was a very, very difficult time. Edith says she lost weight during this time. If any of you have ever spent any time living with somebody who really isn't happy to have you there, but who insists you ought to be, you'll know how difficult it was. But it was a very hard time. And again, Edith writes about that very helpfully on page 280. She says this: "Do we mean it when we say to God, 'Lord, I am prepared to take a low seat. I am prepared to serve somebody,'" because she had said that, I am prepared to go take this time, not have an apartment of our own, to go and be with my mother-in-law, even though she's a difficult person. I'm prepared to go and take that low seat and be a servant there. But we have to realize when we pray like that, that again there is a cost to bear, and that then we will try to serve God with gladness in that situation rather than resent it the whole time. After all, it's an answer to our prayers again. We have said, "Lord, I'm willing to do this." Then we do it. It's going to have a cost to it. God doesn't automatically change the difficult person just because we've said we're prepared to go and try to help them. The person often stays difficult, as the person did in this particular situation. But again, there's a very important spiritual lesson there. If we say to God, "I'm prepared to be a servant," we'd better mean it, because he'll test it and we will be refined by it, because being a servant like that is never a pleasant experience. It's always costly, and we have to work then at maintaining a mentality of serving God and serving the difficult person willingly and cheerfully, rather than angrily and resentfully.